Morning. Confusedly, I just bumped into someone who was trying to find his way, and he took out his program, and he said, "I'm looking for Dora Hosier." And I said to him, "You're going over to hear about Leonardo." And he said, "No, I'm going to look for Walter Isaacson and David Rubenstein." And I said, "Same difference." Kenneth Clark, the art historian, said, "One of the most defining attributes about Leonardo da Vinci was that he was relentlessly curious. And there are probably no two individuals that embody the relentless curiosity that we're going to have on stage here in conversation than David Rubenstein and Walter Isaacson. They're two of our great humanists. And when David speaks and Walter writes, you feel as close to history as you're breathing. We're very excited about this conversation, Walter and David."
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it very much. Thank you. Thank you.
So, how did you have time when you have this job to write another book? Can you explain to people how you can run the Aspen Institute and write books at the same time?
David, for some of you, there are a few of you who were there, last night at dinner gave away my secret.
Right. Okay.
And I was deeply embarrassed, but do you want to tell the secret?
Well, the secret is this. When Walter's parents conceived Walter, there was an interest in the part of his father in having somebody who was a person who could change the world and make a difference in the world and be involved in a lot of public policy things. His mother wanted somebody who was an author. And as it turned out, twins came out, and they named both children Walter. And so one Walter actually writes the books, and one Walter actually runs Aspen. And they never appear at the same place at the same time. That's the only way I can think about how Walter does this. But other than that theory, how do you actually write? Do you write in the morning? Yeah. When do you do your research? How long did this
book take
you?
I will say someday I hope to be able to introduce David, especially one of the Carlisle gatherings, and steal that joke, since somehow he runs Carlisle and is also a great public policy intellectual and patriotic philanthropist. People have hobbies. Some people find a lot of time to play golf or to go fishing. I actually like to write. It is, as Kathy, I saw a walk-in, knows, if I'm sort of had a bad day or a tiring day, I totally relax by just sitting there and reading people's notebooks or studying and writing. Secondly, you have a certain amount of hours in the day. They kind of expand if there's something you like to do. You can always find time to play golf or, do something. But you have to eliminate certain things. We do not have a TV. At all. No cable, no TV, no nothing like that, either here or New Orleans. And I don't go to movies, which bothered Kathy quite a bit for the first 20, 30 years of our marriage until she finally decided she could binge watch them on her iPad.
Okay. So you actually write in the
nighttime.
All right.
I am a very much a night person. In fact, I just waking up right
okay.
now and having my coffee,
right.
but I like staying up till 2 or 3 in the morning.
Who does the research for you?
I do the research. I mean, I feel that it's like having somebody bait your hook when you go fishing. You miss kind of the fun of it. The research is actually the fun part. On particular books, I'll have specialists. Einstein, there are about 5 people acknowledged, one of whom you may know, Brian Greene, not who did research, but who said, "Okay, I'm going to go paragraph by paragraph with you through general relativity and the curvature of space." Likewise, with Leonardo, there are about 5 or 6 people, including an Italian who, Marco Chianchi, who's written some books on Leonardo and helped with some translations.
Okay, so you spent 5 years on this book, more or less?
Yeah, although you kind of gather string for years, you kind of have it in the back of your mind, this is an interesting topic. So I remember I was just last night sort of redoing a part on Lady with the Ermine, which is in some ways my favorite picture. I know the Mona Lisa right. is the best, but Lady with the Ermine is this unbelievable picture. And I remember it's in Poland, but I remember seeing it once in a tour that was in London and then in Houston. These are all 10, 12 years ago, and I didn't quite realize it, but I was gathering string.
Hey, let's go through this. Why did you pick Leonardo? You've written books about geniuses, from Kissinger to Einstein to Steve Jobs and so forth. Why did you pick Leonardo?
Well, Leonardo was great at spotting patterns. He loved to see all sorts of different things. Say, oh, wow, the curl of the water, the curl of the hair, the curl of the wind, they all follow the same formulas. And I was beginning to see a pattern in the people I wrote about. Even Henry Kissinger, who is, as you know, extraordinarily smart, but smart people are a dime a dozen. The people who matter are the creative people. And he was very creative in the way he approached the three-way balance. And going step by step through each one of the people, it was the connection of the humanities to the sciences, or, you know, connections across disciplines, especially with Steve Jobs, Einstein, and Ben Franklin. And I said, who's the exemplar of that? In fact, Steve Jobs would say, you know, his hero was Leonardo, because he loved art. He loved, Steve did. He loved calligraphy. He loved design. He loved engineering. He also loved electronics. And he said, well, Leonardo's the great hero. He pulls it together.
So if you had all these individuals together, who would get the highest score on an SAT test?
Yeah, Einstein, you know, the interesting thing is there's only one person in that entire mix who is really smart, meaning Albert Einstein. He had the mental processing power you see rarely in people, whether it's Newton or Einstein, or in our day and generation, we've known, I'll say them out loud, you know, Larry Summers or Bill Gates, and you go, oh, wow, that person has absolute mental processing power. The others were part of my theory that smart people only get you, being smart only gets you so far. And so Ben Franklin's not the smartest of the founders. I mean, you have Jefferson, Madison, all these amazing people. But he's actually the glue that can bring people together.
So if you could have dinner with any of these geniuses that you've written about, who would you like to
have dinner with? Well, up until recently, it's like, okay, man, you know, especially with the beer, you'd want Ben Franklin. But now I'm just so totally entranced by Leonardo da Vinci. He's just a... You know, he's somebody who always had friends around him. I tell you, I mean, if he were alive today, Jim, he should be at the top of your list to run the Aspen Institute. Because wherever he goes, he gathers, you know, he goes to the court of Milan and he gathers the smartest, you know, artists, the smartest sculptors, but also the smartest playwrights and mathematicians. Luca Pacioli is recruited by Leonardo to the court. And every night they put on, a Sforza Ideas Festival. And he is somebody that would just be energizing to be with.
When you're writing about somebody who was born in 1452 and lived in the 1400s, there's not as much contemporaneous descriptions of them as when you're writing about somebody who's been alive when you're alive. So if you could actually know or have a chance to meet with Leonardo, what would you like to ask him that you couldn't get out of your research?
First, to quickly take on the premise, there's more than 7,000 pages of his notebooks. And, you know, you can go see them in my townhouse because you can print out parts of them, but I, you know, also go visit them. And you go page by page, and they're all crammed with wonderful stuff. That's a lot of resources that we don't have for Steve Jobs. I go to Steve Jobs to talk to him, and in the 1990s, he was working on Next Computer. I say, okay, let's get all your memos. You cannot retrieve, you know, his emails and memos from there. Paper is an absolutely wonderful technology for the storage and retrieval of information. So with, you know, Leonardo, so if you're writing things, your tweets and your Facebook posts are not going to be available 500 years from now or even 50 years from now. But if you take notes on paper, it's there. So we have a lot more on Leonardo than you think.
But if you could ask him any question.
Yeah, the question, I'm struggling here. The biggest question on Leonardo is why did you not finish a lot of your stuff?
Let's talk about that.
Yeah, and whether it was the treatises, he was writing about 15 treatises on anatomy, flying machines, etc., or his paintings, Adoration of the Magi, St. Jerome in the Wilderness, he nails it, and then he disappears.
That was the most encouraging thing about the book,
right?
That you could be a genius and not finish things. Yeah. And so I just wondered if, you know, if not finishing things is a sign of genius.
I hope so. And I have lessons from Leonardo at the end. I don't want to spoil them all, but one of them is procrastinate. And I say, you know, we don't actually need to learn from Leonardo because we can do it naturally, procrastinate. But he had a particular way of procrastinating in which he kept gathering more things and letting it ferment. I do think that there's something good about the fact that he screwed up, didn't finish, didn't deliver. Two things good about it. One is he was such a perfectionist, he doesn't give it up. Take St. Jerome in the Wilderness. It's one of his early paintings. He carries it with him his whole life. He starts like in 1480, and he gets the neck muscles wrong. But in 1508, he dissects a human body and has all the neck muscles, and he redoes the painting. Likewise, the Mona Lisa starts in 1503 for some silk merchant. It's his silk merchant's wife. You know, 14 years later, Leonardo's on his deathbed still trying to get the smile exactly right. So it's like he was obsessed with not letting go.
So let's talk about his birth and his life. He's born, as I said, in 1452. Born where?
He's born in Vinci, hence the name, or the Da
and
Vinci.
And he's born out of wedlock?
He was very lucky. Great good fortune to be born out of wedlock. His father, grandfather, great-grandfather, and great-great-grandfather were all notaries, and he would have been expected to be a notary, except for illegitimate children could not inherit the notary business or become members of the Guild of Notaries, and he would have been a very bad notary. I mean, as you say, he doesn't like finishing things. He doesn't like, you know.
A notary was a much more significant job
than
it might be today.
It was like being, I guess, private equity. Or
almost as important as private equity, right.
Being a notary was an important job. It's like being a solicitor. You were a lawyer, not a trial lawyer.
So his father was a notary. Who was the mother?
The mother, you will find out mostly for the first time in my book, although I don't want to take full credit for it. His mother, we know very little about. She's not on the birth certificate. You know, his father and grandfather are notaries. They have all sorts of things on the birth certificate, including the godfathers and all, but not the mother. 5 years later, you learn her first name for a tax reason. It sort of says, son of Caterina, now married to Acca de Brigia. You know, it sort of mentions her, but we never knew her last name. And it was generally thought that she was slightly older and perhaps a slave, because slaves had been coming in around that time with the fall of Constantinople and other things. So Arab slaves have been coming in. That's totally wrong. And it shows that there's always something new to rediscover about Leonardo. As I say, I don't want to take the credit. Martin Kemp, who's coming to our Leonardo Festival, about a very old, distinguished former professor emeritus at Oxford, along with a group of other researchers, and I was somewhat involved, go through a whole lot of names. Everybody's around. And the woman is named Caterina Lippi. She was an orphan. Very, very poor family from Vinci, and had control of her 2-year-old or 3-year-old brother. She was about 14, and she has an affair with Piero da Vinci right before Piero ends up marrying a much more noble woman.
But the father takes possession of the child, and he raises him for the first couple of years.
Yeah, they're somewhat joint custody, because we do know a few times when, Caterina marries a kiln worker who's very close to the Da Vinci family. I think it was an arranged marriage because it was somebody who worked on one of the Da Vinci family pieces of property. And we see that he goes back and forth. There are times he has drawings, beautiful drawings of the Arno Valley from the walk between Vinci and this tiny hamlet nearby.
Leonardo's father then marries several more times and has 12 other children?
Correct. But the first two marriages are childless, which is somewhat complicated because until he's about 15 or 16 or 17, Leonardo has no siblings, and there's always a question of should he be legitimated, meaning
you
can
go
to church. Well, you know,
why did his father not legitimate him?
His father, by the time Leonardo is 12, realizes Leonardo is truly his own person, is a very good artist, has been brought to Florence to live with his father. His father apprentices him in the second best art shop in Florence, and realizes this kid will make a really bad notary. I mean, because he's not like finishing anything, but he's always drawing and sculpting. And so I think the elder Leonardo is always like, I'm going to get married and have a son.
Okay, so
who he does eventually, who becomes a notary.
So at 14, he's apprenticed to a very talented artist.
Yeah.
And then from 14 to 20, he more or less works there learning painting and sculpting. Is that right?
Yeah, he apprentices to Verrocchio and surpasses, of course, the master, especially in the details that aren't just sort of drawn lines, but sort of have the use of shadows, how water flows. The baptism, there are a couple things to look at. One is the baptism of Christ, which comes out of that studio in which Leonardo does the angel on the far left, but also the ripples of water on the feet. And you just see the huge difference between the background stuff Leonardo's doing and poor Verrocchio, who, according to one of the early biographers, which is Vasari, I don't know if Margot Pritzker's here. She gave me a first edition of Vasari, which was very useful. But Vasari is the only contemporary writing about all this, but he exaggerates. You know, he's fake news. But it's sort of Verrocchio throws down his brush in horror because he's been surpassed by his apprentice. I think that's probably, you know, sort of cable TV version.
So at the end, age of 2021, Leonardo gets his own studio, or goes on his own?
Goes on his own with his father, who, you know, fathers of 20-something sometimes go through this. His father's realizing, you're not finishing anything. You know, you're really talented, but you're not applying yourself. And starts writing the contracts for Leonardo. One is to do an Adoration of the Magi for a church in Florence. Another is to do the St. Jerome I mentioned. And the contracts are, I mean, even, you know, your legal department wouldn't be able to parse them. You have, you know, sort of payments, but he's got to pay for some of the stuff. But then there's a land that he gets, but he has to pay the... It's all complicated. And he loses everything, including the picture, if he doesn't finish it. This is Adoration of the Magi, and he doesn't finish it.
So at the age of 21, he's arrested for sodomy with three other men. Mm-hmm. What happened then?
He's arrested. You know, he is gay at an interesting time because he's in Florence, and suddenly Florence is the most tolerant place ever on Earth up until that time. And they like immigrants, meaning all the people fleeing the Ottoman Empire debacle, bringing algebra and wonderful thoughts, just like when we took refugees from World War II, they brought things like relativity and quantum theory that could help us build the bomb and win the war. And the slang nickname for homosexual in Germany and other places was Florenzer, meaning somebody lives in Florence, because Florence was known to be tolerant that way.
But he was never convicted, right?
He was never convicted. He's arrested. The person doesn't come forward. It's an anonymous allegation. And they get put on probation. Fortunately, one of the four is related to the Medici, so that, you know, helps. They get out of it, but then the next time they get arrested, which is a few days later, there's still nobody's going to come forward, so it's dismissed. But it's a complicated issue, as it would be. I mean, we can imagine this, because it is illegal to at least commit sodomy or to engage in sodomy.
But he was not trying to hide it particularly. He dressed. How did he dress? What was his
appearance
like?
He dressed in, you know, purple tunics and pink tunics that came up high to his thigh, and it was... He dressed with a certain flamboyance.
And he was very handsome.
He was known for his staggeringly good looks and grace. I mean, he was strong. He could bend horseshoes, so it was said. He could ride horses more beautifully than anything else. And if you've seen Vitruvian Man, you know, the nude guy doing jumping jacks in the square and the circle, that drawing... That is Leonardo painting Leonardo, I'm pretty sure, because every aspect of the face looks like Leonardo's face. And
so let's talk about some of the things he was obsessed with. He was obsessed with the human body and anatomy. And how did he learn more about it? He dissected humans to learn more about what humans were like?
Yes. I mean, as I said with St. Jerome in the wilderness, you know, your neck muscles, you can sort of see them or whatever. But he decides he's got to dissect, and he goes... You know,
where does he get the bodies, and is that legal to do this? Is it legal to go get these bodies?
It's semi-legal. I mean, he did it in the morgue in Florence. When he goes and does it in Rome for a while, he gets stopped by the Pope. Anatomy and dissections and autopsies were just becoming legal, but it was sort of local option. But what Leonardo does that nobody else had ever done before, because others had poked around a little bit, taking the flesh off to see the muscles. He goes down layer by layer by layer. In his notebooks, he talks about how far you can get before the stench and the degradation, because there's no formaldehyde or anything. So, and he does pictures in layers, so you can see the beginning of the organs, and then he takes the intestines off, you can see that. So it was the first anatomy drawings. They're in Windsor Castle. They're amazing.
He's also obsessed with optics, how people see. Yeah. He thought sight was the most important of the senses. And how did he try to, in his paintings, other things, make it clear that optics and the way you look at things are so important?
Up until his discovery, this is the great connection of science to art, one of 100 in the book, and that's the theme of the book. But up until Leonardo comes along, the way they did art in the Italian Renaissance and most other places was called disegno, which meant you drew the line. If I were drawing you, I'd say, okay, here's the line I'm going to draw, et cetera, et cetera. Leonardo realizes for two reasons that there are no lines in nature. One reason is he dissects a human eye, has got a very wide retina. The light hits at different parts of the retina, so there's a natural blurring. In other words, if you take your finger right there and put it this close, you can see right through your finger, as he shows in his notebook, because different parts of the retina see things, so there's no clear lines. So he invents what is called, famously, sfumato, which is the blurring of lines, and it comes from his dissection of the human eye and optics experiment. It also comes to some extent from his math. He was a very mediocre mathematician because he had never gone to school because he was illegitimate, which was another benefit of being illegitimate. He didn't have to go to school. But so he didn't learn math, but he did understand that a line is a mathematical concept, and the point of a line or something is indivisibly small, and thus you could not have information in a line. You had to have it in a continuum. He was analog, not digital.
He also was very obsessed with nature and the relation between humans and nature. How did he try to study that?
Yeah, it was before the scientific method. I mean, Galileo and Bacon and others hadn't yet come along. But his way of theorizing was instead of sort of, up until then, people just read what was the scholasticism, which was the classics merged with religious overlay, and from that you deduced the way the world was. He said, well, that's ridiculous. I'm going to ignore all that. I'm going to just observe. And so he's the first person to take observations and do inductions, like, okay, I see you. The water always flows in this direction, so there must be a law that causes it to flow in this direction. And he's trying to figure the patterns of nature out. His way of doing it, he was not either trained enough or smart enough to do grand theories, like Newton comes along and says force equals mass times acceleration, you know, those type of theories. But Leonardo figures out patterns, and that's his rudimentary form of theorizing.
And he was also obsessed with flight, birds flying and humans flying. So why was he obsessed with that, and did he actually devise machines that could enable people to fly, or he tried to?
Yeah, one of the things I learned in doing this book that I don't think is either well-known or known at all is that his flying machines started, like much of what he did, from the Last Supper to the machines, because he was a stage producer. His job when he gets to Milan at age 29 or 30, when he runs away from Florence, comes to Milan, is he produces pageants for the Duke of Milan every night. They didn't have TV, they didn't have internet, but they had pageants and plays every night. And he was Joseph Papp, and he did spectaculars and stuff. So you can go through, as I did, the plays that were being performed at the castle at the time, and it's always angels are coming down from the ceiling and wonderful what are called ingenii, meaning ingenious devices, and that, like, helicopter, that famous helicopter, and everybody says, gee, how did he do that? He invented the first helicopter. No, that was to bring an angel down from the ceiling in something called Pluto's Cave. I mean, it was a play they put on. But being Leonardo, having done that, he said, well, let me try to figure out how I can make a real one that we can really fly.
But the inventions that he would draft, none of them actually came to pass. Did they, all these mechanical devices and wonderful things that were going to change the world, he didn't actually ever build any of them, did he?
He built very, very few of them. And there's one or two, the Willock of the gun, whatever. And once again, it is the downside of Leonardo. You get slightly disappointed that there's too much fantasy there. And then slowly you get your head around, well, actually, this is good. This is somebody who pushed the edge of fantasy. We can relate to it a little bit more. It wasn't like just he, you know, went into his dorm room one day and invented BASIC for the computer, and it worked. But he always blurred the line between reality and fantasy. Now, he was a good observer when it came to flying machines. He went down to the moats at the castle in Milan and noticed that dragonflies, whether the wing, the four wings, and the two wings go up and the back two wings go down and they alternate, and which goes up or down faster, and then he compared it to various birds, things that you and I could notice if we actually took the effort. And he does make devices that work quite well for mechanics, not for actually flying, that are based on these observations.
Now, you mentioned he went from Florence to Milan, and that was around the age of 31 or something like that. So he goes there, but he tries to explain to the ruling leader that he's actually good in something that he had never had any experience in. Can you explain that?
It's a wonderful best job application letter in history. An 11-paragraph job letter from Leonardo to the Duke of Milan, I'll call him. He was acting Duke. And the first 11 paragraphs describe all the mechanical things he can build. I can build forts. I can, you know, weapons of war that knock ladders off of things. I can do size and tanks that will blah, blah, blah. I can also engineer the moving of water. Paragraph 11, paragraph 11, I can also paint and sculpt as well as any man. And it was because two or three things. He always had the fantasy that he was more of an engineer than an artist. Being an engineer was a slightly, being an artist then, until Leonardo and then his frenemy Michelangelo come along, was not a high-class profession. You were just, it was like being a cobbler or a fashion, you know, maker or whatever, or a gold beater or jewelry maker. It was a craftsman's job, and he wanted to be elevated, and there was a new class of people being formed. He was one of the leaders of it, but Alberti, Brunelleschi, and others were you were engineer-artist, and that's what he wanted to be. But you read the letter, and it's half-fantasy. That said, it wasn't total fantasy because he gets the job as the engineer, and Milan is always at war, I mean, between France and the Pope and Italian city-states. So I don't think he can fake it, even though he didn't really know what he was doing.
You mentioned his notebooks, and there are 7,000 pages of them. Let's talk about that for a moment. He just would carry around on his waist a notebook, and he would write things down, and he didn't have a lot of paper, so he'd write over things. And how did he... save all these things, and where do we find them all?
By the way, it's not a bad idea. I do it too. Okay. Carry a notebook. This is about the size of some of the ones he put on his belt. They're called field notes. They're, you know, those were his field notes. And I have dozens and dozens of these that someday
will be valuable.
Well, I guess, except for, you know, they're in boxes. I can't remember where they are, and we keep moving. But
For example, Bill Gates famously bought from, I think, Arm & Hammer something that was then called the Codex Hammer, which has now been changed, but what is that?
So of all the notebooks Leonardo did, about half are lost, but that's a much lower percentage than the number of your emails from the 80s that are lost. So it's pretty cool to have half of this guy's thinking. Of those, most of them were rearranged. People had these little notebooks and then the big notebooks, and so there are people at, in the early 1500s after he dies, they get from his heir and Francisco Melzi, these notebooks, and they say, oh, what a beautiful picture of the helicopter. They cut it out and they put it. So a lot of the codices or codexes, like the Codex Atlantica, are, you know, a couple hundred pages, but they're pieced together from a 30-year period of his life where whoever put that one together thought, okay, I want that picture and that picture and put them in. There is one that is on geology and water and earth sciences that is called now the Codex Lester. And it's never been taken apart or rearranged. It is in the exact order he wrote it. It is, to me, the most interesting of the notebooks, although it's almost all about geology, physics, the flow of water, why the moon shines, why you can see the moon when it's dark, meaning... He's the first person to figure out, and it's in the Codex Lester, that when you see the new moon, just sort of faintly, it's a reflection of the sun's light hitting the earth and then getting to the moon. So all of that is in there, and of course Bill Gates, this is, you know, he's a total geek for this. He really, really wanted it. And he bought it from Arm & Hammer, and he was good enough to let it revert to the real name.
And he paid about $30 million for it, and it's worth a lot more now, I guess, probably.
I guess.
After your book, it'll be worth a lot more.
And he's been very generous. I'll give a shout-out, even though they're not here, but one of them will be here in August when we do this. He has a lot of curators. I mean, it's not just a notebook. You have to have it, you know. You can't just... And they're translated, because the problem with Leonardo's notebooks is they aren't well translated and annotated, and that's why some work had to be done on it. And he has been working for 3 years with Martin Kemp, who I mentioned, right, a guy named Frederick Schroeder, who is a curator, and others, to do the ultimate great translation of the Codex Lester. And it's not coming out until 2019. I don't know why, but they gave it to me about a month or two ago, all the translations. So
well,
it was
actually,
nice of them.
it's in Bill's house, and he has a library in his house, and you've been there, and I was there not too long ago, and I saw it. It's very impressive. He also had a document there, a very rare copy of the Declaration of Independence, and it looked like one I recognized that Norman Lear had owned.
Yeah.
And so I asked Bill. I said, "Did that the one from Norman Lear that supposedly somebody bought for $25 million?" He said, "No, that's not it." And he said, "If I bought it for $25 million, I would remember that." But then he sent me an email the next day and said, "Oh, I forgot. I did buy it." And yes.
And those of you who were at the beginning, I guess we're into a document phase here, but some of you were here 4 nights ago when Norman Lear came and explained having taken this Dunlap, which you actually owned and gave to the archives, right? This Dunlap printing of the Declaration. He owned it, and he brought it around the country in a truck I think he got from Home Depot or some wacky thing. And then at the end he said he and his wife fought about it. It was costing him too much money, so he just sold it. So those of you who heard that tale are now getting
that's what happened.
The sequence
he bought it for
$8 million,
and he sold it for $25 million.
Yeah,
pretty good deal. So back to Leonardo for a moment. Let's go through the make sure you get the travel right. Mm-hmm. He goes to Milan, and he's there for how long?
That's a good question. He gets there in 1482. He's there 17 years. Right. 1499, because that's when the French.
And then he goes back
to
eventually
Florence.
To Florence. Okay, so let's talk about for a moment.
Yeah, but just real quickly, born near Florence, Vinci is part of Florence. When he's 29 or 30, he moves to Milan, 17 years there, comes back to Florence, and then wanders a bit to Milan and other places, ends up in France.
You mentioned Melzi. Where he had some lovers or partners, and are they well known?
Yeah, well, they will be after this book, I hope, because they're all amazingly interesting people. And I think there was probably more of a discomfort. There haven't been a lot of soup-to-nut biographies of Leonardo. There have been great works like, I think, Eric quoted from Kenneth Clark's work, which Eric was written in the 30s or 40s, right? I can't remember. But, you know, he's the great art historian, some of you may remember. It's mainly about his art, and I think there was some discomfort in the 30s, 40s, 50s writing about this. To me, it's part of his life and a kind of cool part of his life. So the first real man in his life is a musician named Atalante, who actually travels with him from Florence to Milan. When they go from Florence to Milan, I said he writes a letter, "I want to be an engineer, I can be good for you." He's actually sent as a part of cultural diplomacy, because the Medici in Florence have got to make up with the new Duke of Milan, and they send these two musicians, Atalante and Leonardo, because he was a stage guy and he knew how to do music. And Leonardo creates a new form of lyre, which is was a metal but bowed instrument. And he and Atalante were part of the cultural delegation that gets to Milan. And Atalante is painted and drawn by Leonardo. I don't know exactly their relationship, but they're a companion. They travel together all the time. And there's a painting by Leonardo, one of the almost only 15 or so good finished paintings, called The Musician, and we saw it in Milan. I'm not sure where it's normally based, but it's his only male portrait, and nobody knows who it's of. And it's clearly Atalante, because you look in the notebooks, and, you know, Atalante with his face raised and the sun coming in is something in the notebook, and there's the picture of him. And then you have Salai, a younger scamp. Salai, it means the little devil. He's a thief, a scamp, a street urchin, a poor kid, but ends up in Leonardo's studio as a young man, and eventually is a partner of Leonardo. And it's an amusing relationship because he keeps stealing things. And Leonardo just can't help writing in his notebooks, he stole this guy's pen, he stole the cloak, he stole the leather we were going to use for the play that was welcoming so-and-so into town. But Salai's there all the way through.
So your book points out that he was a genius, which we know, and that he did so many different things in so many different areas. But today, if somebody were to look at his legacy today, the most visible symbols of his legacy are the paintings.
And that's what he was a true genius in. Okay. Despite what he wanted, you know, engineer and painter, he dies in the arms, or at least that's part of the myth or reality, of the King of France, who's made him the engineer and painter for the King of France. But his engineering, despite what he wanted, was at best smart, ingenious, somewhat of a fantasy. His art was the two greatest paintings ever painted.
So let's go through the paintings. We have extant, there are how many paintings?
Depending how you look at them, you could say about 15. Because as I said, you have the Adoration of the Magi, but it's half finished. You have two Virgin of the Rocks, one of which is probably half done by people in his studio because he got into a pay dispute with the confraternity he was doing it for. So you, if you want to say paintings that were at least mainly by him, and are mainly finished, it's about 15.
Okay, one of them, only one, is in the United States. Where is that?
And it's in the National Gallery. Thanks to, you would know the story better, was it Carter? Who was it?
No, it was bought by the Mellon family, bought Mellon. It for $5 million, which was a large sum of money in 1967. Yeah,
but unbelievably good deal.
So they bought it from the Prince of Liechtenstein in 1967 for $5 million. It's the only one in the United States.
It's the only one out of Europe.
Right.
I mean, and it's the only one that, I mean, there's some floating around or whatever, but we know for absolute sure that this is his painting. We know who he painted. We know when he did it. We know every stroke on it was his. And it's, with all due respect, not the best of his paintings, but it's one of the most interesting because every single element of the Mona Lisa is in Ginevra da Benci. And Ginevra da Benci is very early in his career. And by what I mean by every single element, I mean the mysterious smile, the eyes that follow you, the three-quarters profile, so you have an emotional, psychological connection. But even the fact that there's rivers that flow in the background slowly and almost merge in the swirling way with her body, which was Leonardo's vision of how humans connect with the cosmos, the macrocosm, microcosm thing, which is the theme of the Mona Lisa.
So that was painted on a kind of a canvas, right? So he paints the Last Supper. Talk about how the Last Supper is painted and what it was painted on and why it deteriorated.
Yeah, I mean, here's a guy who's supposed to be a good scientist, and he screws this up royally because he's painting directly on a wall in the refectory of the church in Milan where you can still go see it. And his teacher, Verrocchio, had never done frescoes. But the technique for doing a fresco was exactly the opposite of what Leonardo would like. Because you would take just a small patch, and it would be wet plaster, and you had to paint that patch before the plaster dried, and then move on to the next patch, and you couldn't then change it. Leonardo, as I said, changed pictures for 16 years. You know, he'd be redoing it. And the way to do that is you have to use oil paint. We can just do, because he used oil paint with just minimum amount of pigment in it. So it's almost like a glaze, and you just do thin stroke. But if you're painting on a wall, you have to use a tempera, which means the pigments are with egg yolk or something as a binder, not oil, because oil doesn't stick to a wet wall, as he found out. And so, but instead of doing it the correct way as a fresco, he thinks he has a way of using an oil tempura mix and painting it slowly on a dry wall, and the rest is sad.
So he painted it, took 3 years to paint, and it deteriorated with about 100 years later, it deteriorated, but now it's in reasonable shape?
It's gorgeous now, slightly controversial. We were there recently.
Controversial because?
Because Pininbrennan and the curators who restored it, it's about the 20th restoration in the past 400 years, they go back to every single restoration and every single copy, because it was one of the most copied paintings. I mean, you go to Elliot Gerson's college at Oxford, in the dining hall, there's a copy from the original, you know, done by one of the students. So you go back all the copies, and they kind of fill it in a bit with a slightly different type of paint, so that if you're very technical, you can see, well, this is what we're guessing, that this pixel was blue, this blue. But they fill it in slightly, so not every piece of color on that wall was Leonardo's.
And everybody in that picture is Jewish, right?
Yes.
Right. Okay.
I won't get into the Saint. Yeah.
Okay.
Saint
so
John. Saint John was a little. Well, John is falling asleep at the dinner.
Let's go to the most famous painting in the history of the world, the Mona Lisa.
Yes.
Why is it the most famous painting in the history of the world? Why is this, of all the paintings that have ever been painted, why is this the ultimate painting?
Yeah. There's a pretty simple answer. It is, by orders of magnitude, the greatest painting ever painted.
But that's...
It is the most beautiful painting ever painted. It's the most emotional painting ever painted. I will pick any element of it. You can pick the lips, let us say. The Mona Lisa's lips take about 15 years to paint with the tiny bits of glaze. While he is doing it, he starts it in about 1503. He has been interested in anatomy. He's gone so far. But then he decides there's about 22 pages in the notebooks in which he's taking the flesh off the cadavers of faces and discovering things. First, the surface stuff you and I could have discovered, but we don't, which is that the muscle, when you purse your lips, it's easy to purse both lips. And you could purse your bottom lip alone because it's one muscle. But you can't purse your top lip alone because there's no the muscle doing the top lip also connects to other things. Likewise, how the corner of the eye connects to the corner. There's a nerve that goes down there and controls both. You can't move one eye separately from another, but that's also true that the nerves do other things there. So he has all these dissections, and over again, you see on his pages, he's doing different types of smiles, showing which muscles come from the brain, I mean, which nerves come from the brain, and which come from the spinal cord. So just all the subtleties of what we're moving.
The subject of the painting, is it a royal person? Or
no, it is a silk merchant's wife. But real quickly, I know I'm going on and on, but just why the lips are so good. He also discovers that if you look directly and it hits the center of your retina, you see detail. You see the tiniest of lines. But if I'm looking at you and, you know, and I'm seeing Michael Eisner there, what I see better are the shadows because the sides of the retina pick up shadows better. The reason the Mona Lisa's smile flickers and moves is if you look directly at it, you see that tiny detail turned out, and it looks like she's not smiling. But the minute you look at her cheek or her forehead or her shoulder, she smiles at you. So, I mean, it's magical. It is augmented reality, and I can do that with the eyes. I can do it with the river. Everything about that picture connects art and science and emotion.
How long did it take him to paint that?
He starts in 1503, and we know it's still by, it's on, is by, right by his deathbed in 1519.
So why is it in France and not in Italy?
Well, he moves to France at the very end of his life because young King Francis, you know, a great humanist, just like his father-in-law, King Louis XII, falls in love with Leonardo. They all capture Milan for, you know, in the summer. It's what they do in the summers.
Right.
Capture Milan and then ignore it and then go back and capture it again. And they see the Last Supper and they want to take the Last Supper back, which is hard to do because it's painted badly on a wall. But he gets Leonardo to come and he gives him a Chateau d'Amboise, you know, cool place. But you were about to ask something about the motion that I've cut you off on of Mona Lisa.
No, Mona Lisa, it has left France once, at least, come to the United States under Kennedy administration, right?
Under the Jackie Kennedy administration,
and how, you know the story how that came about? Or
All I know is Jackie...
Well, she charmed the president of France, Charles de Gaulle, and she said to him, when they were visiting, can we have the Mona Lisa? And he said, yes. cultural minister resigned in protest, but it did come over, and it was here for a few months.
The lines around in New York City, which I've seen photographs of at the Metropolitan Museum. I know it was in Washington as well, but I've seen the lines at the
Metropolitan. So it was here for a brief period of time. It'll never leave again, apparently. But today...
Well, the other thing that would cause a fall of the French government, but Pierre de Louvain, who is the curator of her at the Louvre, wants to do it, is it needs cleaning. I mean, she's not that dark. This was like the Sistine Chapel.
500 years.
Right, and the varnish is yellowed and cracked. And just like they clean the other picture right next or nearby it, which is St. Anne, mother and child, he's desperate to clean it, but he said, you really, Macron needs a major supermajority before he can survive.
So Leonardo lives until the age of 67,
correct.
My age, so I'm disappointed to read he died at 67. But he,
we're almost there, David.
What did he do in his will? Who did he leave all of his things to?
Yeah, he left, Melzi was his heir. This is the third companion, male companion he has. He leaves Salai, it was a complicated thing because Melzi supplants a bit Salai, but Salai is still around. People in Aspen can probably understand that. And so Salai gets half a vineyard, but there's actually a new companion who gets the other half of the vineyard, but he gives all the art and manuscripts to Melzi, which is the most important
thing. So after all this work you've did on him, do you admire him more than you did before you started it?
Yeah, but it was a roller coaster because you come and you're completely awed. Like, I mean, for years, people, especially my publisher, you got to do Leonardo da Vinci. And it's like, no, I mean, whoa, that's Mount Everest. You know, you just don't climb that one. And I was completely awed by him. And then as you get closer, he has a wonderful tale in his notebooks about it was a riddle. You get a huge giant, but the closer you get, the smaller it shrinks as you see it better. And it's a shadow. The man holding a lantern with a shadow, he's, anyway, you have to be there to, but it's, as you get closer to him, you realize, wait, he's not a genius, and that helicopter didn't fly. And, you know, he wasn't really good at math. He messes up some of the math things, and when he's working on squaring the circle, which he does as a kid. He does with at Milan. And on his deathbed, he's still trying to figure out how to square the circle. All these things. So he's not as smart. You go, whoa, this is disappointing. And that then you realize that not having received wisdom, he observes everything for himself. He says, I'm a disciple of experience. You tell me something, I'm going to have to look at it and discover myself. And so you go up and down as you see, well, fantasy is so much a part of what he does. And then you realize that's the cool thing. You got to blur fantasy with reality. Or that he doesn't finish things. Well, his conceptions are perfect and he doesn't finish things. So discovering that he's an actual human being, just like, well, not you and me, but just like our kids who have strengths and weaknesses, and that he's not, that means we can try to be more like him. When we go outside and see that bird there that's coming down, we can say, does the wings go up faster or down faster when they do it? We can try to observe like Leonardo. We can try to be curious, which is the, you know, playfully curious and inquisitive, which was his ultimate trait. Those are things we can do. We can't be Newton. We can't be Einstein, but we can try to be more like Leonardo.
Now, your next book is?
Geez, I actually truly have, I don't know. No, I don't want to, I want to move off
of
the.
You could write one about another Renaissance man yourself. Why don't you do an autobiography?
Yeah, right. No, no, that would be bad. you know, we're moving part-time to New Orleans, and I think there's a book in there somewhere that all books have themes. The theme of Leonardo is that to truly be creative, you have to work across disciplines. A theme of a New Orleans book, which is to truly be creative, a diversity of talents, like the stuff that goes into jazz or the food there. I could see doing a book that revolves around the 1880s to 1910 when Storyville is creating jazz.
So you were kind enough to give me the galleys of the book, and I've read it, but it's not actually out until when?
October 17.
And can people order it online in Amazon yet?
Yes.
Okay. And do you recommend that?
I will give you, why I'd recommend it, please, personally, is the amount of books they print and the discount that Amazon gives and the amount that Amazon orders and the amount that Simon & Schuster ships all depend, not all, but largely depends on pre-orders. Okay. So if everybody pre-orders it tonight, right, my publisher and Amazon will ship more copies and I'll be able
and
to...
And it's called Leonardo da Vinci. Where'd you think of that title? How'd you get that title?
David and I discussed whether it should just be called Leonardo. The problem or the upside would be a lot of Leonardo DiCaprio fans would buy it.
Right.
And halfway through, they'd say, wait a minute, you know.
Well, it's a great book. It's a great read. And I've read all of your books. And this is another spectacular
book.
Thank
you for reading it. And thank you for the good
questions. All right,
questions.
We have some time for questions. Questions? Right here somewhere? Right here? Hilda?
Thank you so much. That was absolutely genial, what you just did. I'm going to do something that is unforgivable.
Good.
Which is to suggest to a magnificent writer like you, Walter, that you write a book about a woman. Pick a woman.
Well, here's the... I agree. I'll answer it in three different ways. I felt that strongly, and my daughter introduced me to Ada Lovelace when she was writing as a high school kid, The Importance of the History of Technology. And so The Innovators begins and ends with Ada Lovelace, Lord Byron's daughter, who combines poetry and processors to create the concept of a general purpose computer. I think there may be a good book to be done on her. It was difficult. I even thought of trying to sustain an entire biography of her, but for reasons I won't get into, there's not that much material. I'm working with Time Magazine. I don't know if I think Nancy Gibbs just left this morning, but you know, on the Great Geniuses, we're going to do an issue in November of history, and then you have to address the question of why are there so few women, say, considered among the great geniuses, and it's, you know, for reasons. It's not, you know, just happenstance. Right, and that's why I wanted Ada Lovelace. And by the way, if you read The Innovators, Grace Hopper has a whole chapter. The women who do the programming of ENIAC have whole chapters. I've been trying to get people to do movies on these people because, especially in the computer world, the invention of software was done more by women than by men because men thought, you know, boys with their toys, they thought the hardware was the thing. But there are reasons why in the time of let's start with Aristotle, Socrates, and Plato, you know, nobody quite is up there saying who, you know, well, there was no Mrs. Socrates. But, and then you go all the way through. Now, you can look at Einstein, the great Solvay conference when he does it, and there is, you know, one great woman, you know, Marie Curie, and she wins the Nobel Prize twice for chemistry and physics, but she's one of maybe 40 people at this conference. She's the only woman. I could see doing a biography of her. And I have thought of some other women to do biographies of. One of them may or may not fit the mold, but it's a woman who created the best, sporting house in Storyville and first hires Jelly Roll Morton to be the pianist. She's an octoroon, so she crosses the color line. It's right when Plessy v. Ferguson tries to draw the color line. She creates this whole district, or she's the centerpiece of a district in which jazz is invented. So there are things I'm wrestling with, but there are good women that should be written about.
Okay, other questions? All right, let's see. Here, there, anywhere?
Do we intimidate? Here's
one right here.
So you said that the picture died. When he died, the Mona Lisa was at his bedside.
Yeah.
So, in fact, did she ever see the picture, or did the merchant who ordered the picture, did he refuse it, or what happened?
No, I think he wanted it. It was interesting. In 1503, when he's starting to do it, the richest, most demanding art patron, perhaps in history, Beatrice d'Este, the Duchess, you know, of Mantua, everything else, is saying, I will pay you anything. And she's going there, she's trying to meet him, get the portrait. And he won't do it. He does a sketch of her and then won't turn it into a painting. And yet he picks Lisa, I don't even remember how to pronounce the last name, but Girondelli or whatever, who is the second wife of a middle-class silk merchant. Now, he does it for a lot of reasons, one of which is you just look at the picture and you say, okay, I know why he wanted to paint her. But he never delivers it to the silk merchant. And as far as I can tell, looking through all the bank records, he never gets paid by the silk merchant. So clearly he's doing it not to please a patron, but as a universal picture of his own. And he keeps it and travels to France with it because even after 14 years, he's thinking, all right, I can still make this better.
You never heard the theory that that was actually a picture of himself in drag. You've heard that
theory. I've heard that theory. I've heard that it's Salai. I've heard, I mean, there are many people. Everybody, I mean, I must say, even to this week, people have come up to me and said, I have a particular, I've discovered that the Mona Lisa is actually blah, blah, blah. There's about four pages in the book where I hope I truly nail it, that the Mona Lisa is Mona Lisa.
One thing we know for sure, she's not Jewish, right?
Wrong.
Wrong? She is.
His father was the notary for the Jewish community in Florence and helped put together. So he was a silk merchant, and it's intertwined. I mean, I don't know that she's, you know.
Orthodox.
Orthodox, yeah.
Okay, right.
From a biographical perspective, what guides your curiosity in choosing the subjects or themes of your books?
Well, I like the intersection of different disciplines, particularly where the humanities intersect with the sciences. And, you know, different people write about, you know, sports heroes or war heroes or political giants. What interests me is how genius is a function not of intelligence but of creativity. And that's what you see in Ben Franklin. That's what you see in Einstein. You know, I mean, Einstein can't even get his doctorate. I mean, he does in 1905, when he changes all of physics with quantum theory and relativity, he's a patent, third-class patent clerk because he still can't get his doctorate. So, you know, people like that who show that imagination is more important than knowledge, which, by the way, is an Einstein line, not mine. That's what I like to do. I also like to do people who are a bit inspiring, like Leonardo da Vinci, the ultimate of that, because he is the world's and history's greatest genius, period. The most creative genius, period. But he's also somebody who, as you read about him, you say, oh, I could be more like that. I could actually observe things as closely as he tries to, like how a dragonfly's wings go, or ask the questions he asks, like, why is the sky blue? Or why do fish go through water faster than birds through air, even though water is heavier? These he lists in his notebook every week, the simple questions that if we paused and observed harder, we could say, oh, we could be more like Leonardo. My favorite, and it's almost the theme of the book because it's the very beginning of the book and the very coda of the book, is in one day he just writes, describe the tongue of the woodpecker. They go, wow, why would you do that? How would you do that? I mean, you have to get a woodpecker and, you know, open the thing's mouth. Why would you even want to? And it's just curiosity, pure curiosity, not connected, even though half of what he does is connected to his art. Like you know, he's trying to figure out how the lips work. Well, that's connected to his art. But there, most of the time, he's being curious for curiosity's sake. And that's why you all are in this room. You're not here because you're going to get a lot of totally useful knowledge out of an ideas festival. You're here because you're curious about things. And if you read about Leonardo, I promise you, you can up that game 50%.
So have you considered renaming it the Aspen Curious Festival? Okay, right.
A curiosity shop.
Right.
The old curiosity shop that's already used.
I look forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
I read a biography about Leonardo many years ago, and I was awed by the sketches of his different machines that he was, you know, designing. And so I'm wondering, why do you think he didn't make many of those gadgets and machines that he designed?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the questions that disappoint you about Leonardo until you get further along. You say, okay, that's actually interesting and inspiring, is that he loved the conception more than the execution. He would write a whole treatise on anatomy, but then never finish it, polish it for publication. He would draw machines that didn't really work. Part of it, I think, comes from the theater, which is he made some of these things as fantasies or whatever. And part of it was, it was both a weakness but also a human trait that once he had come up with a great idea, at one point he comes up with a great idea for making needles, which would have made him a lot of money because the weaving and business in Florence was just taking off. But he says, this is how much money I could make. If I took this machine, I could turn out needles. But then he never does it. I guess he never ran into a good private equity person.
So I forgot to ask you, what was his relationship with Michelangelo?
Oh, this is, if any of you are going to make the movie of this book, this is the centerpiece scene. Because they're both great artists of Florence. Michelangelo, almost 20 years younger, but they cross paths many times. Leonardo is the most popular guy. Everybody wants to be part of Leonardo's circle. He's got friends. Michelangelo is a loner. He, instead of dressing in purple knee-length tunics, he dresses, never changes his clothes, and it's all black garb. He sleeps in his boots. I mean, he's very much a loner. But they decide to have the greatest art competition in history, which is that the rulers of Florence take the Great Hall of Florence, the Palazzo di Vecchia now, and each are going to paint a battle scene on opposite walls. And Michelangelo starts insulting Leonardo, who could have been a good mentor, but he just, every time he passes him in the street, he mutters bad insults. And they both start painting their battle scenes. And it's almost they're looking over each other. Once again, Leonardo's have problems because he's painting with oil paint on a wall and doing it slowly. Michelangelo's having problems for a totally different reason, including the fact that he's, I think I can go here, but he's a bit freaked out because Leonardo has his young male friends and his retinue. Michelangelo is gay, but if you've read about him in the Agony and the Ecstasy, he's very religious and very, very agonized about it. But everything that Michelangelo paints in his part are nude men bathing in a river, which have very little to do with the battle he's supposed to be doing. But the entire scene is just them bathing in the river, which causes the rulers of Florence some puzzlement, because Florence has only won like two battles in history, and they generally like lose to Milan and Rome and everything. But they found these two, they even lose to Pisa, which is hard to do. So they found these two battles that they actually went in. Leonardo's painting, you know, capturing of the standard and swords and horses, and there's Michelangelo just painting them bathing. So they both give up, and Leonardo hightails it to Milan. Again, because he just can't stand the whole scene and ends up, you know, doing quite well in Milan with The Last Supper. And Leonardo and Michelangelo, in order to get work, finally decides to work for the Pope and paints the Sistine Chapel.
Walter, thank you very much for a very interesting conversation.
Great.